Welcome to Scripps Jihad Radio. I'm Kevin Barrett, bringing on exciting guests with important things to say that aren't being sufficiently heard in the mainstream. Today, I'm going to be talking about, well, it's one of the elephants in the living room, especially post 9/11. That is the outrageous bigotry against Arabs, Muslims, and Middle Easterners in general, in our corporate-controlled mainstream media in general, and Hollywood movies in particular. I'm honored to have with me today Jack Shaheen. He's the author of Real Bad Arabs and made it into a film. It's by far the most impressive thing that's been done on the topic, which, as I said, is pretty much the elephant in the living room of bigotry. You know, we hear about all kinds of bigotry these days. Well, this is the biggest and least questioned of all of them. So to hear about it from the horse's mouth, let's bring on Jack Shaheen himself. Welcome, Jack. Thanks for coming on.
No, it's my pleasure. My pleasure to share thoughts.
Right. It's interesting that, you know, until your book came out, I'm not sure how, you know, nobody really seemed to notice the fact that Hollywood movies are just one, a long, you know, parade of slander against Arabs. How could they be making movies like this for so many decades and nobody noticed this?
Well, I think the stereotype was so well embedded in our psyches that no one really paid much attention to it. Even when I first started doing research on the topic back in the early 1980s, people were looking at me like, what am I doing? I mean, why bother? And what I found to be, you know, disturbing as well as quite fascinating is that after I discovered around 200 films, I thought I had a book. But they kept coming, you know, until I reached over 1,000 pre-9/11 movies. So I had uncovered in the research over 1,000 pre-9/11 films that had, in one way or another, vilified Arabs. And then when the book came out, which was just prior to 9/11, although there were many reviews, in fact, most of the reviews were quite good, it was ignored in Hollywood and in New York, the two major centers. No one took the time to look at the book, to talk about the book, to discuss the book, you know, Variety, Hollywood Reporter, the New York Times. It was ignored. Whereas, you know, had the book dealt with any other group, certainly it would have gotten, I think, much more visibility. And it's just that when you grow accustomed to a stereotype, it's very, very difficult to unlearn our prejudices. And this has been with us. These images have been with us for more than a century. And it's still a problem, although in some ways it's gotten better. In other ways, since 9/11, it's gotten much, much worse.
There's a sort of a sociology of bigotry. It's always really interesting, you know, to see which groups are bigoted against whom, what forms of bigotry are acceptable in what circles, and so on. It seems that bigotry against Arabs, Muslims, and Middle Easterners has always been more acceptable in sort of the upper and middle classes, the professional and educated classes, whereas bigotry against, let's say, black people, you know, homosexuals, etc., is more acceptable among lower classes, but not so much upper classes. It's why do you think that the elites are so given to this bigotry against Arabs?
Well, you know, it's a very good question, and I think part of the reason is the Arab-Israeli conflict. I think it's political. That if, although this may sound a little off the wall, that if for some reason you want to humanize Arabs and Muslims, you're anti-Israel. And I think that some people are reluctant to do that for fear of being targeted as being anti-Israel. Now, if you were to ask an educator or a politician or any of the so well-educated people, okay, that doesn't necessarily mean they're knowledgeable, but they're well-educated. If you were to ask them why, I'm sure they would not tell you that was the reason. But I'm assuming, you can never prove something like this, that that's one of the primary reasons. Also, it's, you can get away with this one. You know, it's sort of like, you know, people that like to pick on others know they can't vilify Jews, gays, blacks, you know, lesbians, Asians, Hispanics, because they'll get it one way or the other. But if they do it with Arabs and Muslims, if they say, we don't want a mosque in this area, if they say that, like Republicans running for president, you know, competing with one another as to who can vilify Islam more than, you know, I mean, it's still acceptable. And one of the main reasons why it remains acceptable and the tragedy of all of this is that you don't have major Hollywood stars condemning this stereotype. You don't have major political leaders. Even our president has failed, I think, to step. You know, and I'm an Obama supporter. I supported him both times, and I really, you know, he's a decent man. But he needs to step forward at some point and say, you know, 25% of the American people think I'm a Muslim. Well, what if I were? What difference does it make? Are we saying that an American who, you know, who goes to a mosque should not be president? I mean, is there something wrong with this? And if so, what? So let's have this dialogue. And I, you know, maybe he'll do it the last year he's in office, but it has to come from the top and filter its way down.
Right. It's I think Edward Said pointed out that the kinds of bigotry against Arabs and Muslims that were prevalent in the past, let's say, you know, pre-World War II, pre-establishment of Israel, were more on the sort of romanticized, you know, harem fantasy, relatively harmless compared to what came later, although not entirely harmless because, as Said points out, it helped the colonial enterprise dehumanize these people and say that, oh, they're sort of childish and primitive, and that's why we get to come in and take over their societies and impose our values. But
yeah, they were the butt of our jokes, right?
right. But still, you know, the Rudolph Valentino Sheikh seems pretty harmless compared to today. You know, ever since Israel was established, we've been getting these Hollywood action movies that really picked up steam, you know, in the 60s and more so in the 70s, you know, just more and more, it seems like, every decade, showing these guys as terrorists. All the Arabs, all the Muslims, just, you know, it seems like all they're ever doing is coming, you know, killing innocent Americans and then being bloodily killed and tortured in justified revenge. I mean, this is really, it's not just bigotry, but it's become really hideous, kind of, you know, violent, almost, you know, violence pornography type of bigotry.
Yeah, it's interesting. I think historians later, not necessarily now, but in the near future, will really look at this. You know, I mean, I was solo for so many years, but now there are other scholars coming to the forefront, looking at this issue, and people like yourself talking about it on the air. I think that when it is finally exposed, it's going to cause some shockwaves. It hasn't happened yet, but I'm confident in 10, 15 years from now, all this bigotry will kind of come to the forefront and we'll say, my God, did this make the war in Iraq that much easier? Because all these years we've dehumanized Arabs. Therefore, when the president says we're going to go after Saddam Hussein, nobody says anything. It's easier to go into Afghanistan. And, you know, Afghans, Pakistanis, Sikhs, seen one, seen them all, because of this dehumanization process that's been with us for so long. Of course, it's had an impact on our policies. And, you know, even recently there was a fellow from Michigan on the Republican National Committee, Dave Agee, I think, I can't, David something or other, but he's from Michigan, he's on the Republican National Committee, said something to the effect that Muslims have never, there's never been a Muslim who contributed to anything positively to our society. And the Republican Party lets him go. I mean, he's still, I mean, the man should be removed. I mean, he simply should be removed from that committee. And there's no outrage and very little press coverage. But had he said that about a Jew or about a Christian or even a Buddhist, you know, God help us, you know, what would have happened, the outrage that would have taken place.
Well, you know, maybe he should be introduced to another Republican congressman from Michigan, a former congressman named Mark Siljander. Siljander was also very bigoted against Muslims. He was a very conservative Christian. He went to D.C. and walked out of a prayer breakfast because it was featuring a Muslim. And then somebody tapped him on the shoulder and said, you should go and, you know, study closely the Quran and the Aramaic versions of the Bible, which was the language Jesus spoke. And when he did, he learned that actually Islam and Christianity are very, very close. In many ways, right. Muslims today seem to be following something closer to the Aramaic version of Jesus than a lot of Christians are. And so Mark Siljander then became a great public diplomat. He actually was had some, you know, insider associations, apparently, and made peace in many parts of the world. Then post 9/11, he got railroaded on a ludicrously trumped up charge and spent a couple of years in prison. But, you know, when I hear about a Republican, you know, bigot from Michigan, you know, yammering this way, I think, well, you know, he really needs to sit down with Siljander for a couple of hours.
Well, he needs to sit down with somebody, or somebody should take him to the washroom, take out a bar of soap and, you know, just kind of cleanse his tongue, you know, clean him up a little bit. Yeah. You know, that's what you do with, anyway, I shouldn't say that, but that
well, no, I hear you, because the thing is, this kind of talk really does contribute to a lot of, you know, violence and murder. And you know, it does seem that the dehumanization of Arabs and Muslims in the media paves the way for an immense amount of torture and murder in real life.
That's true with every group historically. I mean, that's why we were able to. You know, look what happened when we vilified African Americans in our country for so many years. You know, families would watch a lynching, and have a lunch and take photographs because the dehumanization process was so effective. You know, look at the Holocaust in Europe and Nazi Germany and beyond. I mean, that was made possible in large part. Not only to the campaign that Hitler launched, but a dehumanization process, which said that basically Jews were uncouth beings, greedy, destroying the country, so that people, without thinking, built up this hatred against Jews, against their neighbors, against people that they knew and loved at one time. And then you begin vilifying them, and look what happens. So these stereotypes don't exist in a vacuum. They injure innocent people. And somehow we have to – the guy in Michigan, by the way, is Dave Egema, A-G-E-M-A.
Okay.
And he's a member of the Republican National Committee. And I think the quote exactly was, have you ever seen a Muslim do anything positively that contributed you know, to the American way of life? That's his quote.
Wow. Talk about a vapid, meaningless way of demeaning people. It's just outrageous. You know,
yeah, I would love to meet with Dave sometime. You know, have a cup of coffee with him and ask him why he said that, you know.
Yeah, well, I hope you get a chance. You know, there's another.
I will. I go to Dearborn fairly often.
Oh, okay.
And the next time I do, I'll see if I can set up a meeting.
Sounds like a plan. Well, I hope that gives some results, although I'm not going to hold my breath until people like him are cured of whatever ails them.
You know, well, it's always nice to talk to someone. You never know. You never know how people can change.
Hmm. Well, Siljander is a perfect example of that. I mean, he went from being one of the biggest bigots around to one of the greatest peacemakers. And I'm hoping that, you know, his health is okay and he's going to pick up where he left off. You know, speaking of there's another Dave, Lieutenant Colonel Dave Grossman, who wrote a really interesting book called On Killing, The Psychological Cost of Learning to Kill. And he went over all of these military studies about these discoveries they made after World War II, that most of the infantry guys were not trying to kill the enemy. They would either shoot over their heads up into the air, or they wouldn't shoot at all. And only about 10% or less were really trying to kill anybody. And only about 2% did almost all of the actual killing. And so they did these studies, and they tried to figure out how they could raise the percentage of troops who would really try to kill the enemy. And what they learned was that a kind of Pavlovian dehumanization of people based on these ethnic stereotypes was the key to the whole thing. So they would have the people, you know, over and over and over, like shoot at some target image with the ethnicity that you were trying to teach them to kill.
Right.
Asian, if it was Korean, Vietnam, and now, of course, you know, Arab or Muslim. And they got the shoot-to-kill rate up to 50% in Korea and up to 90% plus in Vietnam. But this exacted a terrible psychological cost on these troops because, you know, 2% of men are psychopaths who can just kill you as easy as they can swat a fly. They're the ones who almost always did all the killing in war. And then, you know, everybody else is somewhere else on that spectrum. And so the, you know, normal people and, you know, relatively compassionate people, once you've brainwashed them to become killers, racist killers, which is what our military does in basic training, you know, they come home and they say, oh my God, what have I done? And they end up, you know, committing suicide or going crazy. And so it's, you know, this, well, Grossman points out that movies and video games are exactly, you know, they're exactly what the military does to brainwash people to become killers. He was afraid that movies and video games were going to create all kinds of serial killers, that young teenagers, just normal teenagers exposed to these means of teaching them to hate and kill would go out and become killers. And there's some evidence that that may be behind the rising murder rates and so on. But in any case, that Grossman's insights show us that these movies that you've studied are not just harmless fantasy, that they really are a conditioning process teaching people to kill a dehumanized victim.
Well, he's absolutely right. And it's not only members of the military, it's teenagers today who are exposed to all this violence. And, you know, I mean, I just saw a movie called Two Guns that got rave reviews, and I stopped counting all the deaths, you know, with Denzel Washington. And bang, 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 and there's this new NBC series called, what, Backlash or something. Oh, I can't think of it. It's on Sunday night. It's gotten rave reviews. Anyway, I was watching that the other night, and the same thing, just killing people as if they were flies on the wall. And you can't continually expose young people to these images over and over again and expect nothing to happen.
Right. It also seems really counterproductive from a strategic point of view, even if we just come try to pretend that we're, you know, psychopathic, amoral beings and just look at things strategically. Conditioning people to hate and loathe the ethnic group that they're going to be sent over to, you know, supposedly impose order and keep the peace and, you know, impose American power on these places. It's crazy. I mean, no wonder it doesn't work. No wonder these wars are disasters.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I mean, it's all you can do is, you know, what I try to do in my lectures and when I speak with individuals such as yourself is to just say, you know, who benefits from this sort of thing? You have to ask yourself, does anyone benefit? And does anyone really walk away? I mean, do we as citizens of our country benefit when we vilify someone, regardless of their color, creed, or culture? What's the point of it, you know? And we have to be aware of the consequences, the loss of life that comes as a direct result of the vilification of a people. And I think that, in some way, is a wake-up call. You know, Dr. King said it better than anyone else when he was in a jail in Birmingham. He said that the people of ill will have used their time more effectively than have the people of goodwill. And that the people of goodwill have to get up off their duffs and become movers and shakers and stop remaining silent and really speak out against all sorts of injustice. And until that happens, I'm afraid that situation is going to stay pretty much the same. It may even get worse. So we have to break the silence on this issue and come to the forefront. And that's when it'll happen.
And, well, you mentioned that one of the reasons that this kind of bigotry is acceptable in elite circles is it's a pro-Israel thing, that if you object to it, then you must be, you know, anti-Israeli. You must be with the terrorists. And that leads to the observation that it seems like there's getting to be more of a split in the American Jewish community, which, of course, is the main bastion of support for Israel, although the right-wing Christian fundamentalists are another bastion. But there seems to be more and more questioning of this kind of, you know, Israel at any price, you know, Israel right or wrong mentality in the Jewish community. You know, we're seeing younger Jewish people in particular starting to question things more. We're seeing people like Gilad Atzmon and Philip Weiss, the former New York Times journalist, questioning some of these kinds of reflexive pro-Israeli positions. And do you think that the American people in general and the Jewish pro-Israel community in particular are going to be slowly coming, you know, becoming more conscious about all this?
Well, I think as the Israeli or the American Jewish Peace Now movement increases, you know, as it gains more and more momentum, organizations such as AIPAC will eventually fade into the horizon. I don't see it happening right away. AIPAC is too strong. But I certainly think, you know, you can be, I'm not Jewish, but if I were an American Jew, I'd be committed to the state of Israel, but not the Israel that we see today, a state that lives in peace with its Palestinian neighbors, that stops settlements, that tears down the wall. You know, and I think, you know, you have to give American Jews involved in the Peace Now movement a tremendous amount of credit, because they're getting it from both ends, you know. They're getting it from Arab and Muslim radicals, and they're getting it from Israeli or Jewish radicals. And yet they're persevering and they're moving forward, because they know for the future of Israel there's got to be peace, and it's got to be an equitable peace. And so I think it's gaining. I think it's gaining in momentum, and the old guard is scared. That's why they're lashing out. They're very frightened of what may happen, you know, because the kids aren't buying into this mythology anymore as they once did. They're just not doing it. The realities on the ground are changing that.
And I guess I would probably count in your schema of things as one of those radical Muslims that would be giving sort of at least many of the Peace Now Jews a hard time, because, as would many of the, you know, the Jewish folks who are questioning these things,
right,
in that, like, you know, this whole business of, you know, what's good for Israel, et cetera, you know, doesn't impress me. I mean, as far as I can tell, Israel is really just a code name for an illegitimate genocidal settler colonial project, and the only way to solve the problem is to put an end to the whole concept of a so-called Jewish state and have all of the citizens, the rightful citizens of mandatory Palestine, live as equals under an equal protection clause. I just don't see how you can possibly cling to this notion of a you know, Jewish privileged state and you know, have anything but the kind of situation that we're in.
No, there's no rationale for that. You know, there was if you go back to after the Holocaust, you understand why that sort of fixed mindset existed, but not today.
Mm-hmm.
Not today.
Right.
You know, things change, dynamics change, politics change, people change. You can only be hardcore and violent so long, and it catches up with you.
Mm-hmm. That's right. So getting back to the topic of movies, one of the most interesting examples, which is discussed some in your book and film, I believe, is Aladdin. And I was horrified by this film because, you know, I remember in film school, I was shown a clip of the original Big Bad Wolf film, The Three Little Pigs by Walt Disney, which includes a notorious segment of this anti-Semitic stereotype of the evil Big Bad Wolf, who is a Jewish peddler with a big hooked nose and who's coming to blow down the house of the nice, you know, goys, the pigs. And,
right,
you know, this was Disney's, you know, biggest black mark against his whole career. And then Eisner buys Walt Disney Studios, and one of the first things he does is he puts out this film Aladdin, in which the evil hook-nosed vizier character is based on the Big Bad Wolf. He's the same character, big, tall guy with a hooked nose, talks the same way. I mean, it's just a renewed version of this anti-Jewish stereotype, but now it's an anti-Arab stereotype. This blew my mind.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's a shame. I had a discussion with Jeffrey Katzenberg about the film, too, and he said, you know, it was a big mistake. And I said, what? He said the Arab-American community didn't rally and support this film. And I said, you've got to be kidding, you know. I mean, that's how insensitive he was to the whole issue.
Wow.
He didn't see anything wrong with it. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah,
if
you look at those characters, okay, the bad guy is that vizier, who's the anti-Semitic, you know, bin Laden, you know, evil Jewish peddler guy.
Jafar. Now, you know, I didn't know whether you knew this, but Jafar has reappeared in a ABC television series.
Oh, no.
Yeah, he's back. He's back on TV. Once Upon a Time in Dreamland, I think,
And that name, they took Jafar. That's the founder of the Shiite jurisprudence. And that stereotype was also obviously aimed at Khomeini. And the good guy, the good Arab in that film, is this ineffectual fat little sheikh who represents basically a U.S. Israeli-controlled puppet, you know, sitting on one of the thrones of these Gulf oil dynasties that we own. Now, that's the good guy.
Yeah.
And he's naive, yeah. And he's being manipulated.
That we see for just a few seconds now and then.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Yeah.
Well, no, there's a long way to go. The nice thing about the documentary, though, and what gives me some encouragement is that it's still being shown in colleges throughout the country. And people listening to your show, it's easy to obtain. You just go to www.realbadarabs.com, R-E-E-L, badarabs.com. And it was done by the Media Ed Foundation in Northampton, Mass. I worked with them on the film, and they just did a beautiful job in exposing the stereotype.
You know, I was over at the Fajr Film Festival in Tehran last year, where there was a whole section on this kind of topic, including Iranophobia, which was sort of the latest thing with what was the name of the film? The one about the hostage crisis. I'm having a blank. What was it called? The one that won the Oscars, like.
Not Without My Daughter.
No, but one of the other, just the recent one where the about the CIA guy making.
Argo.
Yeah, I don't know.
Oh yeah,
name,
Argo.
As you can imagine, the Iranians just love that one.
Yeah, Argo.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Because I saw that on the plane over to Tehran,
and it could have been such a good film, you know, but they made it a cowboy Indians movie.
Yeah, you know, if they'd really given full shrift to the Iranian viewpoints, I think it would have been even more interesting.
Yeah, would have been very interesting.
You know, so add some ambivalence, you know. But
yeah, my favorite scene for the stereotype is the souk, when the guy accosts, you know, the woman and the man, and I'm saying these people have never been to a souk, because had they seen some American tourists in the souk, the first thing they would have done is try to sell them something.
Oh, that's right. In a very friendly manner, perhaps an
you
overly
darn,
friendly
yes,
manner.
In a very friendly manner.
Right.
Rather than attack them, you know, you want to buy something, you know, and right then and there, I lost it. I couldn't watch anymore.
Yeah, well, as I said, I saw it on the plane on the way to Tehran. And fortunately, you know, I wasn't born yesterday, so I didn't get off the plane expecting to, you know, be surrounded by a bunch of, you know, murderous America haters who were trying to do me in.
Yeah, well, you know, a few years ago, the Iranian director, I think the film called The Separation, you know, a beautiful film about a couple that wants to divorce and they're fighting over custody of their child. When he received the award, the Academy Award, he had this beautiful speech. I wish I'd kept the clip. I could probably get a copy of it, where he says, don't demonize the Iranian people. You know, they're just like other people in all parts of the world. You know, you can sort of say what you want about our politics and some of our politicians, but not the people of Iran. It was a beautiful, beautiful speech, you know, and I think that's something we need to remember.
Mm-hmm. Well, I certainly found that the Iranian people were very, very friendly, warm, welcoming, and that included the, you know, hardcore anti-American political types. In fact, those are the people I was mainly hanging out with, the intellectual segment of them. But when I went to the anniversary commemoration of the Iranian Revolution, I was out there marching with, it was more than 3 million people, I believe, in Tehran. And these are all the kind of, you know, hardcore pro-revolutionary people. And there are signs all over the place, including Death to America. But, you know, people would say, oh, are you American? And so they tend to be apologetic about the signs. You know, this slogan has really kind of worn out its usefulness, et cetera.
Yeah.
So, you know, the people are all, you know, very, very, very nice, very welcoming. And it seemed I could kind of sense that way things were going. This was February. It was before the election when Rouhani won this totally unpredicted victory. You know, the American media was telling us that Rouhani couldn't possibly win because we all know that Iran is really a dictatorship and they don't have real elections. And the hardcore people don't want Rouhani to win, so he can't possibly win. And then he goes and wins in a landslide in an election with hand-counted paper ballots, as opposed to our elections, which are run by rigged devolved voting machines. You know, we've had presidential elections stolen in just the last decade. So it's the media seems to be dedicated to giving us this completely you know, black is white, you know, up is down, you know, ignorance is strength, freedom is slavery kind of picture of these things, that there's been no real recovery in the mainstream media, but the internet seems to be changing the game. Would you agree with that?
Well, the internet, I think Al Jazeera America, once it gets its legs, once they get on firm footing, will be a major step upwards. I really do. They're trying to be very objective in their reporting. Right now it's a little boring, but I think it'll get much better. I think the reports are much better. They're much more thorough. You don't have talking heads yelling and screaming at one another. CNN continues to put everybody to sleep. Fox is so bad. It's so pro-conservative, pro-Republican. Even the Republicans are turning it off. You know, they can't stand it. MSNBC is so liberal. Who can watch Rachel Maddow anymore? You know, it's just very, very difficult.
Hey, how about Press TV? I'm a regular right. talking head on Press TV, so I have to give them a shout out.
Yeah, well, you should. I mean, you should. But I think that's changing. You know, corporate control, there are only five major corporations controlling everything now. And that's why you see all the hype on all the new films, which are really pretty trashy, because they all have vested interests in the films that are being promoted. Mm-hmm. Anyway, you know, the most important thing is to say what you think and not to remain silent. And hopefully in time, the images will change.
Hear, hear. Well, do you think we may have turned a corner a little bit with the prevention of a U.S. bombing campaign against Syria? You know, there was that false flag or apparent false flag incident.
I think Americans are tired of war. Mm-hmm. I think we know now, we don't talk about it, but we know that Iraq was a mistake. We didn't know. Most Americans got bought into Bush and Cheney and the lies and Rumsfeld that were told to us. But we're not that stupid, and I think the younger people in particular are aware of that. Mm-hmm. And we know that Afghanistan is wrong. So in spite of, I think, media manipulation on the part of special interest groups, we're a lot more astute today than we were, you know, back when we went to war against Iraq.
Now, I'm a little concerned about the peoples of the Arab world right now, who I always thought were a little bit ahead of the people of the West in seeing through government lies, maybe because their governments were so much worse at lying. But today, I'm very concerned by this sort of sectarian propaganda that looks like it's mainly the Saudis that are, you know, spreading it through the Middle East. There's all kinds of violence going on in Syria, Iraq, and Lebanon. Right now, it seems there's a sectarian thing that, you know, the Saudis are supporting Al-Qaeda, quote-unquote, and, you know, the U.S. and Israel seem to be coming down on the side of Al-Qaeda in this effort to split up the Arab world. I think you're from an Arab background, right?
Yes.
So what's
But I know on? I know very little about Middle East politics, and it's not really my area. I just know that it's a tragedy that you see Syrians killing Syrians and Iraqis killing Iraqis, and at some point, you know, I hope and pray that the people in those regions will put the politics aside and learn how to live together and stop it, you know, and just stop this nonsense and this waste and loss of life that really is so tragic. You know, shame on them. You know, I'm sure their parents and grandparents are looking down on them, you know, and sobbing, you know, just a steady stream of tears, all the violence is taking place.
Mm-hmm. And unfortunately, I think that our own nation, the USA, has contributed quite a bit to this process. It seems like there's a kind of imperial divide and conquer strategy that involves, you know, going, you know, invading these countries, or whether overtly or covertly.
Well, I don't think, but I doubt it. Particularly Syria, I think they brought it on themselves. Who knows what's going on now in terms of whether we're arming this faction, whether somebody else is arming that faction. But the Syrians primarily have brought it on themselves. And the outside forces, whatever, whoever they are, God knows, nobody knows who they are. Or if they do, they're not saying.
Well, some of them we know about. Bandar Bush and his Saudi intelligence, for instance, supporting the al-Nusra Front. And why is the U.S. on the side of this, you know, self-proclaimed al-Qaeda ally? I don't see how the American people cope with this.
I don't know. You're asking someone who does not know Middle East politics. I know about stereotypes and the impact that they have on people, but on the region, you need another guest.
Okay. Well, yeah, let's talk a little bit more about some of the Hollywood stereotypes and some of the films, you know, in particular. What are some really egregious or noteworthy films that portray these stereotypes that you've looked at?
Well, you know, in the book, it's really difficult to single. There's so many, and so many different time periods. I would say probably the one, there are several that will stand the test of time to be up there with Birth of a Nation as some of the most racist films in the history of American cinema will be Rules of Engagement, you know, with that certainly is where the Marines slaughter all those poor Yemenis. True Lies, the Schwarzenegger film, The Kingdom, which is set in Saudi Arabia. But there are dozens, I mean literally dozens of films that exist that vilify Arabs that are really very, very difficult to watch. The Delta Force, the Chuck Norris films. It would, you know, I'd hate to have to go back and review what I've written on all those different films.
There are only
I think in over 1,000 films I recommend for viewing about 20 or 25, and the best were like Lion of the Desert, film that came out, an independent film that came out not so long ago called The Visitor, which I liked very, very much, about a Syrian immigrant who's forced to go back into his country and the way he's treated. But it's a very nice film, The Visitor. And the good news is there are three Arab-related films being nominated for Oscars. You know, there's Hani Abood Assad's film, Omar. You know, Palestine is being represented. There's the Square documentary about Egypt. And there's another film about the revolution in Yemen that's being nominated. So that's, I think, kind of interesting in cinema. So we'll see. The things are changing slowly. We'll just have to wait and see.
Well, Lion of the Desert was really an excellent film in so many ways, and I thought it was also really nice and refreshing to see a fairly accurate portrayal of the fact that the people who were resisting this kind of imperial colonial onslaught on their homelands, by and large, are relatively
heroic. It's a brilliant film. Yeah, it's my favorite of all time. It's a classic,
it's a
very good view of Islam, and it's based on a historical event. The Libyans were incarcerated, they were tortured, they were brutalized by their Italian occupiers, by the fascists at the time. It's a great film. It's just a terrific film.
Yeah, and it kind of gets the big picture right, which is that
it was done by a good friend of mine and passed on
a
terrorist attack. You know, very, very sad, Mustafa Akkad. But before he passed on, he left us with this great film. Huh. Anyway, listen, it's been great to discuss this with you. I've got a chore that I have to do in about 2 minutes.
Well, I better let you do the chore.
No, but was there anything else you wanted to?
Well,
send me a link so I can listen to
it. I absolutely will. I have to ask you one more quick question, or my listeners
will strangle me.
So the question is. I don't know if you've looked into the various kinds of research that have been done on 9/11. I've been spending more than a decade on this. I got witch hunted out of the university for doing research on this. And my conclusions, in a nutshell, are that 9/11 was essentially scripted by Hollywood-type people, filmed, storyboarded, and then they blew up the World Trade Center. Precisely in order to create these horrific images, you know, the fireballs with the alleged plane crashes and the demolitions of the towers, designed to create a Hollywood-style spectacular to imprint very deeply in people's unconscious minds the same kinds of emotions and ideas that we've been talking about. It's a very, very horrible thing, and most people don't even want to look at this, and I wondered if you had yet gotten around to it.
I have not, and I probably will not, because I'm totally consumed by the work that I do on perceptions of Arabs and Muslims. Again, this is another area for other specialists to look at and discuss and bring to the forefront. But you know, when you focus on the issue of how Arabs and Muslims are portrayed in American popular culture, you know, you need about at least 100 or so researchers or scholars,
right.
And I'm still pretty much alone in doing it. So, no, I am not.
Well, let's put out a call for more people to do research along these lines, and you know,
in areas that you've mentioned, the ones that I've talked about. But I leave your listeners with just one piece of advice, and that is, you know, if you see somebody being vilified, whether that person's a gay, a lesbian, a Jew, an Arab, don't sit still and remain quiet. Speak out. You know, don't let your friend or your neighbor engage in prejudice by remaining silent. Because if you're silent about it, that means approval. So speak, be a mover and a shaker. That's what I always, when I move around and I hear that, I always think of Dr. King's words, and they help me a lot. Even though I'm 78, you see, I keep thinking I'm a mover and a shaker.
Well, Jack Shaheen, you are a mover and a shaker, and your book and film, Real Bad Arabs, that's R-E-E-L, Bad Arabs, is this is one of the greatest contributions to speaking out courageously against bigotry that I am aware of. So keep up the terrific work, and thank you so much for coming on.
Oh, yeah, thanks a lot. Take care.
Bye-bye. Radio. Kevin Barrett bringing back another guest today. We had Jack Shaheen on for the first 40 minutes talking about the outrageous bigotry against Arabs and Muslims in American society, even in the elite upper middle classes where people like to think that they're not prejudiced. Well, we're going to continue that conversation right now with Richard Hugues. Richard Hugues has a very interesting blog. It's richardhugues.wordpress.com. He's been published at Global Research. He has a bunch of articles on drones, which are pretty alarming. And I'm bringing him on now because he commented on my recent article about how Ariel Sharon's legacy is being whitewashed by a bunch of lying Zionist propaganda outlets. And one of those outfits that's a spinoff from the Mossad, I think we can be pretty sure, it's called Camera. It's over in Boston. And Richard is in that area, and he's done some investigative journalism exposing the lying Zionist propagandists of Camera. Well, hey, welcome, Richard. It's great to have you on the show.
Thank you, Kevin.
So, yeah, I read your 2006 expose on Camera, which I hadn't seen before, but it's... You know, sometimes it's hard to keep track of all of these Zionist outfits that are systematically poisoning the American discourse.
The outposts here in Boston, I live on the Cape Cod, but Boston is 75 miles away, and I go there frequently. And I know that, that Zionism has an outpost in Boston because... there's lots of political activity up there in which they're involved. The Camera group, C-A-M-E-R-A, was founded by a guy named Charles Jacobs, who he's sort of like the man who creates front groups for Zionism in Boston. He also created the David Project and the American Anti-Slavery Group. The David Project is a group that's sort of like Daniel Pipe's Campus Watch. It's for promoting campus activism in favor of Israel.
And what a misnomer. The David Project, I assume that's referring to David and Goliath, and I would say the Zionists are hardly the David in that struggle.
Well, they themselves say that they want to turn that perception around. They know that the world is starting to see them as the Goliath, and they want to try and claim that they're the David in the world scene, that is, the underdog. Mm-hmm. And actually what the David Project is involved in doing is going on to campuses and finding professors who are critical of the Israeli role in Palestine and attack those professors. So it's always the same method. The underdog here is actually the attacker, and what they do is send a student in, and the student makes a complaint to the administration about the supposed pro-Palestine views of the professor. The professor comes under question by the administration, and there's a campaign to get rid of that professor. This happened with Joseph Mossad in a movie made by the David Project called Columbia Unbecoming. And it's happened again this past year at Northwestern University. Columbia is in New York, and Northwestern is in Boston. Northeastern is in Boston. And the same method. The student goes in. A student is an Israeli supporter, and he complains about prejudicial academic teaching going on in school, and it was basically an attack by the David Project of people who aren't towing the line for Israel.
Yeah, just like Campus Watch. You know, when I was teaching at University of Wisconsin, it was, I think, 2003, I was teaching Arabic, and I remember I had a student named Zach. Shout out to Zach if he's listening to this. A very cool guy. He lived in Saudi Arabia quite a bit with his parents when he was growing up. And he wondered why I hadn't yet been attacked by Campus Watch. Uh-huh. He came during office hours and said, "Hey, you know, how come you're not on their list? You know, you need to be working harder." And so I said, "Well, why don't you turn me in?" And then the next thing you know, he took me up on it, and he wrote this really hilarious satirical letter, you know, posing as an insane Zionist student, you know, turning me in. And I, you know, when I read, I was laughing when I read it, and then suddenly I said, "Yeah, wait a minute. I don't know if I it might actually, you know, they might not get the joke." But then the joke was on me, because a couple of years later, Campus Watch and Lynn Cheney and her group, all of the Zionists and right wing Republican groups suddenly started witch hunting me for my 9/11 research. So I did make up for lost time. It's pretty chilling, you know, on campus when. Everybody on campus pretty much, you know, the vast majority of them are sort of liberals and relatively well-informed, and they understand the basic nature of what's going on in the Middle East. But they're afraid to talk about it because of this kind of harassment.
This is the point. This is an effort to keep people in line who are even thinking of crossing over into criticism of Israel. But the interesting thing to me is the way everything is always couched in terms of protecting the underdog, being fair to all sides, what I call the language of the progressive and progressive liberalism. This is the perspective from which the Zionist attack people who are in support of Palestine. So that, you know, it's sort of like the U.S. has to go to war with countries because of their civil rights. They need to protect other people. Well, the Zionists claim the same thing. They need to protect the underdog, the poor Israeli state.
Yeah, well, what a scam that is. You know, it seems that the Zionists have this long history of making out like bandits by posing as the persecuted in order to justify their own persecution of others.
You know, you have to wonder how long this has been going on. You know, the conventional view is that in the Christian world, Jews have traditionally been horribly persecuted all down through history. And there certainly are a lot of examples where that has happened. But you have to kind of wonder if there's another side to that story based on what's been going on in the past century, and particularly since Israel was formed in 1948, where this scam of being the poor, you know, the poor persecuted scapegoat is being used to make them the world's biggest persecutors. You know, that they persecute anybody who stands up to them here in the U.S. They're exterminating the Palestinians in a complete genocide, and doing this by justifying themselves as being the poor, innocent, persecuted scapegoats. It's really bizarre.
Well, getting back to the situation here in Boston, the group that Charles Jacobs founded, called the David Project, was also instrumental in an attack on the construction of a mosque in Roxbury, which is a neighborhood of Boston. The Roxbury Mosque was almost complete, and Jacobs and the David Project mounted a serious campaign just to stop the building of a mosque. And I wrote in my article on this subject that such a thing would be unthinkable if a synagogue was being constructed in Roxbury or a church, an Episcopalian church, for instance. Nobody would even think of going after a religious group in such a blatant way. I think what the Zionists are doing is sort of like a case of projection in psychology, where the very things that they are, that they say that they're the victims, but they're actually the persecutors. It's a classic case of projection.
It seems that way. And there are so many cases where, you know, somebody spray paints swastika on a synagogue, and it turns out that it was a Jewish person that did it, and they're usually said to be unbalanced. But, you know, then we have this kind of false flag terrorism where even Jewish targets get bombed by the Mossad. Happened twice in Argentina, and they're finally starting to expose that. And it turns out, you know, if you read these books like Ari Ben Menashe's book, I think Prophets of War, and some other exposés by Viktor Ostrovsky, other ex-Mossad members, it turns out that all of the big Palestinian terror attacks that were splashed across the headlines when I was growing up were all done by the Mossad. You know, Klinghoffer, the poor old Jewish guy in his wheelchair who was pushed overboard of the ship Achille Lauro that was hijacked ostensibly by Palestinians, it turns out that that was a Zionist job. That was a Mossad operation. You know, the Mossad killed Klinghoffer. And, you know, you'd have to really wonder about the psychology of these people. You know, Ariel Sharon famously said that he didn't mind if he had to burn down a few synagogues in the West to terrorize the diaspora Jews into supporting Zionism. That was one of those quotes that I recently wrote about that have been suppressed by the mainstream media thanks to these groups like Camry. And it's funny how they're, you know, even a lot of nice liberal journalists in the U.S. are running interference for these guys by going along with the charade that, you know, Ariel Sharon, oh, maybe he didn't really say these things. Why do you think that even sort of critical-minded, you know, liberal people with principles end up getting co-opted?
Well, I think that they're sucked in by the language of the progressive liberal, the term I mentioned earlier. For instance, another group that Charles Jacobs founded, the American Anti-Slavery Group, was all about saving the people of Darfur in South Sudan. And, you know, it turns out that Israel has a real interest in South Sudan, and that the whole campaign to save Darfur, so-called, was a phony. It was all about vilifying Arabs and Muslims, the Muslims of Khartoum and the state of Sudan, in order to basically separate South Sudan away, which is what was accomplished by that campaign.
Well, that's right. That was part of the Seven Countries in 5 Years plan that General Wesley Clark exposed in the wake of 9/11. He said the neocons are going to try and destroy seven countries in 5 years, and they haven't quite gotten all seven, and it's been a lot more than 5 years, but you can see that plan. And one of the countries they had to destroy was Sudan, and as you said, they split it up into two countries. I mean, would anybody allow a non-Muslim country to be destroyed in that way? I don't think so.
No, but I guess I should have made my point clear that this campaign to attack Sudan was waged on the basis of the need for the world to stop slavery. The American Anti-Slavery Group, which Charles Jacobs founded, was all, you know, claimed to be about stopping the practice of slavery in Sudan.
And I bet he didn't mention that Israel is the world leader in human trafficking.
Yeah, well, let's forget about it. It wasn't about slavery at all. It was about attacking Muslims. In fact, you know, that's the big gift that Zionism gave to U.S. imperialism. Attacking Muslims became the replacement for attacking communists.
Well, that's right. And I personally think that 9/11 was set up very, very elaborately and carefully to make that transition. And I'm sure my listeners have heard that before. You know, Richard, it's been a wonderful, all too brief conversation, and there are so many other things I could talk about with you, including your work on drones. You've written some very cool fiction, too. I actually started, it was almost addictive. I started reading that, and I'm like, whoa, wait a minute. I've been reading these like miniature vignettes of your fiction for like half an hour, and I want to keep going. Like, so that's pretty cool stuff, too. I want to have you back on the show and talk about some of these other topics another day. So, hey, thank you so much. Keep up the good work, and remind us of your website.
Okay, thank you, Kevin.
You're at Richard Hugus, Hugus, .wordpress.com. All right, well, talk to you soon.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, bye-bye.